The slave trade in earnest began in the 16th century and lasted into the 1860s. Now, the question of how much money did it make, that is a fantastic question and also a highly contested one.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. Now, when I spoke to Leonard Wunschikon recently, one of the topics we discussed was his research into how the slave trade has influenced levels of trust in Africa, a level of distrust that you can still measure today. It's one of many pieces of economic research into the impact of the slave trade on the places from which the slaves were captured and transported. Well, can we also make a link between the slave trade and Europe's economic development at that time? Elora de Runancourt of Princeton has used new methods and new data to investigate that question. When I spoke to her, we talked about the records that she used and the insights that she discovered. Elora, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, Elora, tell me about how the Atlantic slave trade worked to enable those slave traders to make money.
Well, first of all, the Atlantic slave trade was a form of long-distance, high-risk trade. So in order to actually get merchants involved and for them to actually make a profit, the primary form that it took at the time that it occurred was through contracts, monopoly contracts issued by crowns throughout Europe. So these monopoly licenses gave merchants access to broader financing networks. They also gave them, in some cases, what were known as sub-sovereign powers so that they could actually use military might to, say, prevent other merchants from trampling on the rights of their monopoly contract. And this heavy involvement of the crown and the state is what enabled the trade to develop. It was very hard for private merchants on their own to embark on something of this nature.
How long did this go on for? How much money do you think that they made in total?
So the trade lasted several centuries. The earliest voyages between Europe and the African coast date back to the 15th century. I would say the slave trade in earnest began in the 16th century and lasted into the 1860s. And now the question of how much money did it make, that is a fantastic question and also a highly contested one. And the reason for that is, you know, we don't have the kind of data we would like to answer it. If we knew the accounting books of every single company involved in the slave trade across all the different crowns that were involved, over all the years that they were involved, that would be one thing. But instead, we're left with partial records. You know, so maybe the records for one company have survived and scholars have taken a look at that and tried to make estimates. So you see things out there like in the mid-1800s, the slave trade was bringing in over 1.6 million pounds into Britain each year. Other estimates of the profits are, you know, they range as high as 33% or more. And I think the consensus has been in the sort of quantitative economics or quantitative social sciences literature to greatly revise that downwards, more on the order of 8 to 10% in terms of rates of return.
One thing we do have better data for these days is the economic development of the countries that profited from the slave trade. During this time, how great was Europe's economic development?
Europe was experiencing rapid but uneven development during this time period. So, you know, in the 1600s, you had the dominance of Italy and Spain as economic powers. But by the 18th and certainly by the turn of the 19th century, France and especially Britain had taken off and they were industrializing. So they were growing rapidly. GDP was growing rapidly. All these, you know, industrial powers were rapidly urbanizing.
So there is an economist who we associate with the idea that Europe grew rich partly on the profits of the slave trade. His name is Eric Williams. For people who are not familiar with Eric Williams, can you tell us a little bit about him?
Eric Williams was a Trinidadian historian, actually, and he was born in Trinidad and Tobago in 1911, and then he studied at Oxford. And as part of his doctoral studies, he focused on the relationship between capitalism and slavery. And in this really important work of his, he argued that the profits from slavery and the slave trade are what financed and powered the British Industrial Revolution. And it was a highly controversial thesis both then and today.
What evidence did he have at the time for that?
So at this time, scholars are mostly working with national aggregates, data on trade, data on GDP, those kinds of statistics to make sort of what we would call today a time series argument. You know, you have the growth in slave trading and its value, and at the same time, the growth of the British economy, and you kind of want to link those together. And the argument is really driven, again, by these rough estimates of how profitable it was to engage in slave trading. And so Williams also cites these numbers of, you know, returns on investment of about 30% or more. And this was such a major part of the British economy. It's clear that these funds were used to then finance the Industrial Revolution and capitalism.
Now, if you look up Eric Williams' name today or his book, you'll find that there are plenty of people who have disagreed and still do disagree with his hypothesis. What are their arguments?
So if you take a really narrow read of the book, you could quibble with this precise, you know, statement about the profits from the slave trade being sufficiently large to have funded the Industrial Revolution. So there's many pieces that you could pick apart there. And, you know, as I mentioned, scholars have revisited the numbers game, you know, for the slave trade and concluded that there's no way it was, you know, first of all, that the returns could be higher than 30% or just kind of as a piece of the economy that could be that large. But there's another way that you can interpret the Williams thesis, which is just to say that, you know, through many potential mechanisms, the slave trade and the Atlantic economy in general were critical to the development of modern European economies, or in the case of Britain, industrialization. And instead of focusing narrowly on, say, profits from the slave trade, one might think about linkages between different industries. So you have the development of shipping and then the development of finance, financing of long distance voyages, insurance, et cetera. So these are kind of industry by industry spillovers of the slave trade. You have the idea that the slave trade is connecting merchants and European powers to new markets in the New World. And this is giving them access to cheaper raw inputs that are also helping the economy develop, because those are inputs into, again, further industries more industrial sectors.
So let's talk about your research, Elora. What part of this do you decide to investigate?
I'm an economist and trained in sort of the modern tools of economics, where the kind of question that we ask is really about counterfactuals. It's about, you know, if there was less of a slave trade or no slave trade at all, how would European economies have developed? And this is very different from saying, looking at two time series, you know, I mentioned this before, okay, this is the number of slave voyages, this is how much they were worth over time, this is how the British economy was growing. Isn't it obvious, you know, point made. Instead, we try to seek out variation in, I would say, you know, exposure to this form of trade, and then ask, the more you're exposed to it, you know, is that associated with growth compared to some comparison group that's less exposed? So when I started to look into this question, the first major task was data. We need data and we need variation. And I stumbled upon this immensely rich database of the Atlantic slaving voyages that historians have spent over a decade putting together. And, you know, really goes back even further, several more decades, of tracing together individual slaving voyages to the point where they created a database that covers something like 80% of the transatlantic slave trade. And what I noticed is the database contained really detailed information on where each voyage left from, you know, the literal latitude and longitude of where voyages departed from, which ports, where they went, where they ultimately landed, over the entire period of the slave trade. And I decided to connect that with subnational measures of economic prosperity. And for this period, which is covering, again, the 1600s roughly through the 1800s, there's not a lot of subnational data on income, but we do have information and measures of urbanization. And there are several papers in the economic history literature looking at economic development over the same time frame that use this as an indicator of economic prosperity. So I decided to do the same.
I see. And this is data of a level of detail that Eric Williams and a lot of the economists who followed him would just not have had access to.
It would have been impossible. You would have to go archive by archive and sort of make these inferences based on really individual cases.
So using this data, Elora, can you make a link between slave trading in a port and the growth of that port?
So the way I went about this was to, you know, again, take the data on these voyages, and I wasn't the first economists to use the data on the slaving voyages, but people were looking at primarily the African side of the trade and noting how areas that were more exposed to the trade developed more slowly and had issues of, you know, mistrust centuries later from that contact with Europeans, that negative contact. But nobody had looked at the departure side of the trade and actually connecting these voyages back to the ports that they left from. So I decided to do that. I linked the ports of origin to my data set on historical urban populations for European cities. And then I ran an analysis that's called a two-way fixed effects regression. And let me just explain that in, you know, layman's terms. What that does is ask, you know, within a city, how do changes in the number of slaving voyages that have left from that city correlate with changes in the city size for that area? And doing that helps because, you know, we can talk about sort of all these threats to how we interpret this relationship. But a key concern is that you have major, rapidly developing urban centers that were just more poised to take advantage of the Atlantic slave trade. And therefore, you know, that's what generates the sort of reverse causality, generates the relationship between city population and slaving voyages.
Yes. In your conception, if I'm right, these cities are the winners from the slave trade, if we can think about large portions of Africa as the losers from the slave trade. But there is that objection, isn't there, that these might already have been very prosperous, successful cities, and therefore they attracted that trade. How can you rule that out?
So in addition to thinking about how increases in slave voyages for a given city correlate with changes in their city population. So that already helps address, you know, aren't we just comparing London and Liverpool to Whitehaven? You know, in addition to that kind of analysis, I thought to ask, well, what are some of the main threats? You know, what would link city growth and slaving voyages in such a way that's not explained by the, you know, the benefit from participating in the slave trade? And a key alternative hypothesis is that really the slave trade is just one component of overseas trade. So major trading nations and cities were, of course, also involved in slaving voyages, but really the way they got rich was from other forms of overseas trade, you know, different commodities that they were either exporting or importing from the quote unquote New World. So I had to come up with ways to deal with that as well.
So what did you come up with? How did you deal with that?
Well, I spent a fun summer in the National Archives at Kew. And I discovered that in the archives, they have an amazing collection of what are known as port books, which record trade at a port level, covering, again, several centuries, all the way back to the 16th century and into the 18th century and 19th century even, for every port in the UK, with the exception of London, which unfortunately was all the collection was burned to make room. This happens often in economic history, and it's very sad. Now, these books were physically available in the archives, and there were 20,000 of them. So a summer wasn't really going to cut it for, you know, going through each of the books. Not only that, they were manuscripts, meaning handwritten records of every ship entering and leaving those ports, and even including what was contained in those ships. Very detailed, but I, to be honest, couldn't really read them. And they were in various stages of disrepair. You can buy a postcard at Kew of a mummified rat that was found in the pages of one of these port books. So instead, you know, I tried to come up with another solution, and I realized that the archive had really done a great job of cataloging in their online catalog every single port book and providing some information about them. Most importantly for me was the number of folios or pages in the book. And from having gone through hundreds of the books myself, I saw that depending on the year, the books were either thinner or thicker. And so it seemed as though the folios were added as needed, probably because they were animal-based, you know, paper, and they were expensive. So the thicker the book that year was an indication of more trade. And that information I had from the online description of the item in the online catalog, and I scraped that information and created a port-level data set that gave me a sense of trade volumes. And the books were separately organized in terms of domestic sea trade and overseas trade. And so that was the key thing for me. I had a measure of overseas trade, at least for British ports outside of London. And that's what I used to directly probe this question of whether overseas trade was explaining the effects I was finding.
And this also minimizes the chances you're going to find another mummified rat, doesn't it?
Hopefully.
Now, also, you could say that these changes happened over a very long time, over a couple of centuries, and Britain was unrecognizable at the end of that period as it was at the beginning, and many, many other things have changed. Can you separate the profits from the slave trade from every other thing that was happening?
Right. So, again, my approach here was to take what I felt was the biggest alternative explanation. And the analysis I was able to do, I think, addresses some of the other potential stories that you're telling. So for the UK specifically, I could then focus on what were known as the outlying ports, which got access to the slave trade in the 1700s, early 1700s. And this meant that the Royal African Company lost its monopoly trading rights and private merchants were allowed to enter, which means that ports outside of London could start to enter. And focusing just on these outlying ports, I could do the same exercise of saying, the more that you as an individual port engaged in the slave trades, you know, did your population, your urban populations grow faster than ports that were less engaged? And remarkably, I found nearly identical estimates of the relationship between slaving voyages and city population growth. And I think what's helpful is that we already have taken out of the equation what's going on with Liverpool, Bristol, and London, the three biggest slave trading centers of the UK, and instead are thinking about, this is exactly the kind of counterfactual I want to ask. You're a smaller port. You may or may not engage in this form of trade. You have other options available to you. I measure how much overseas trade you engage in as well. And I ask, on top of that overall overseas trade engagement, does the proportion of your trade that's in the slave trade correlate with city growth? And I find that it does. And I'm looking at the development of these cities contemporaneously. Now, admittedly, if you look over the very long run, Dover, Deal, Whitehaven, they're not exactly the powerhouses financially of the UK today, right?
No.
And so I think the argument that I wanted to make is more about this contemporaneous connection that showed that engaging in the slave trade was profitable, at least on this measure of economic development, for those places involved. But we might ask a different question of how that ultimately filters back to the rise of the UK as an economic power overall, which has to come back to, again, these really important centers like Liverpool for industry and London for finance.
From all this detective work, can you then come up with some kind of estimate of how the slave trade contributed to the economic growth at this time?
You know, the first step here is, again, establishing a plausible, compelling answer to this counterfactual question of, you know, is the development that we see in Europe or in the UK today, is it somehow contingent upon engagement with the slave trade? And that gives you, you know, we do get estimates out of this. For example, I have an estimate of, you know, a 10% increase in slaving voyages leads to a 1.1% increase in city populations. To get from there to a financial, a monetary, you know, estimate requires several more assumptions. And people in the literature have done this. You know, they've built general equilibrium trade models that have thought about appetite for risk and the linkages between different sectors and how do you come back to the value of that investment in the economy. And there's even some very contemporaneous or contemporary work that's looked at this question. I think we need first to get a handle on, do we believe in that causal relationship? And then how can we make the most grounded assumptions and reasonable assumptions possible to get at these numbers? So I consider this paper an input into what I hope will be a new literature that's arriving at this question. But certainly what I found is entirely consistent with the Williams hypothesis. So I think this is one step in that direction.
I was going to ask that because, what is it, 70 years on, the Williams hypothesis is still as controversial as it ever was. It seems like you're producing evidence that does support what Eric Williams was arguing.
Yes. And again, I think there has been a revival in quantitative attempts to look at this question in economics today, including a recent paper by a former colleague of mine looking at slave wealth and the Industrial Revolution and finding that indeed slave wealth helped relax the financial constraints to invest in modern technology, and that helped spur industrialization. There's other work that's looked at really the finance side of these, of this economy, of the slave economy. So in the US, for example, and in the state of Maryland, looking at whether individuals were slaveholders or not affected their access to credit, and finding that those who could pledge enslaved people as collateral had actually greater access to credit. So there are all of these connections being established with quasi-experimental evidence that suggests, yes, this linkage is there. And that is consistent with that broader interpretation of Eric Williams' hypothesis that I mentioned earlier.
One of the reasons that it is so controversial is because it lends itself to the argument that the nations that grew rich on slavery should compensate those that were impoverished by it. Does your work help to resolve this debate?
Certainly not resolve it, but I think certainly keeps it alive. And again, it's one step in the kind of information we'd want to have to then progress to making some calculations and estimates of the monetary value of this investment or engagement in the slave trade for these economies today.
Well, it's fascinating work. It's a fascinating story as well. And these are very important conclusions as well. So, Elora, thank you so much for talking about them today.
Well, thank you again for having me. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Elora's research is published as Atlantic Slavery's Impact on European and British Economic Development. That's in the Journal of Historical Political Economy, Volume 5, Issue 1. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe. Wherever you get your podcasts, you will find us. All our past episodes, as always, are at voxdev.org, where you will also find articles about the topics we feature. And if you like what you're hearing, please tell someone else about us and leave us a review.